morning. Please be seated. Forgive me if I mispronounce this case is Burdick Noli v. White, case number 55691. Our counsel may proceed. All right. Mr. Eisenberg, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Before I start, I want to make sure the timing issues are correct. My understanding is that we were given 20 minutes. Mr. Clauser, we've agreed that he would take 1 minute at the end just to briefly explain his position. So I have 19 minutes. I'm going to attempt to reserve 5 minutes for a rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. Robert Eisenberg, appearing for the appellant, Tim Burdick-Noli. As the court is aware, there are several issues in this case, and in the interest of time, what I've tried to do is come up with the three issues that were probably the most prejudicial issues that came up during trial. Any one of the three, we believe, would justify a reversal and a remand for a new trial, but combined together, it's overwhelming prejudicial error, and those issues have to do with the mid-trial settlement and the approval of the settlement with Western Engineers as being in good faith. The mid-trial change of the judge's mind when he dismissed the fraud charges, but then after some more witnesses testified, he reinstated the fraud cause of action. And the jury instruction number 23 that dealt with the definition of the word encumbered, which we believe shows that the judge had a fundamental misunderstanding of Nevada law, which says that water rights are the equivalent of real property, and they're treated as real property under Nevada law. Now, with regard to the settlement and the good faith settlement by Western, it's important to keep in mind that it was virtually unanimous at trial, up until the time of the settlement, that Western and Western's bad advice was the cause of this entire fiasco. Western, the engineers at Western, the water experts, were familiar with Mr. Burdick-Noli's water rights. They're the ones who told their client, Mr. White, that they could, that Mr. White could use Burdick-Noli's water rights. They're the ones who brought the buyers and the sellers together. The testimony was unanimous at trial by Mr. White. He said, Western engineers told me I could use Burdick-Noli's water rights for my project. Retirement, the tire store, they said, Western engineers told us we could use Burdick-Noli's water rights. Burdick-Noli testified, Western engineers told me my water rights could be used by these buyers. And even Western itself, they admitted in the answer, and their principal, Mr. Smith, admitted on the witness stand that Western engineers told the buyers and the sellers that Burdick-Noli's water rights could be used for this project. Now, why couldn't they be used? Because on the third page, there was a designation that the water rights were temporary. And as it turns out, temporary water rights can be used for a rock quarry. And Mr. Burdick-Noli, he crushes rocks. He's not a water engineer. But his permit said temporary. So even if the rock quarry goes on for 100 years, it's still considered a temporary use because eventually the rock will run out. But temporary water can't be used for residential because residential is permanent. The testimony at trial was that any first-year professional engineer with half a brain would have recognized that the temporary designation on the third page of that permit would create problems for those water rights being used for residential. Now, that's not my characterization. That's what the evidence was. Any professional engineer, first-year professional engineer with half a brain would have recognized that problem. But the testimony established that Mr. Kentley, one of the water engineers at Western, didn't look at the third page, didn't see the temporary designation. So on the issue of the good faith determination, with regard to the factor of the court's balancing the relative liability of the parties, and whether the settlement is disproportionately unfair compared to their liability, it was overwhelming. It was always up until the time of the settlement, the case was teed up to blame Western. In the opening statements, plaintiff's counsel told the jury, Western committed misrepresentations against my clients. Western conspired with Mr. Bertinoli to pull this whole thing off. After the settlement, he told the jury, Western never made any misrepresentations to my clients. So everything changed, and that's one of the reasons why we believe not only was the judge wrong in determining that the settlement was in good faith in the first place, but once he made that determination, he didn't do anything to ameliorate the prejudice that it caused for Mr. Bertinoli. For 4 days at trial, I think it was four, maybe 5 days at trial, it was the focus was primarily, not entirely, but primarily on Western. All of a sudden, Western was gone. All of a sudden, there's an empty chair there, and Bertinoli now is the only one being blamed.
For the co-defendants settle all the time in civil cases. What should the judge have done?
Well, in the middle of trial, when there's a settlement like this, and when the damages that the plaintiff is contending are tied to what happened in the settlement, what defense counsel asked for, and I submit to you that it was a reasonable request, is, first of all, he asked for a mistrial because he said that changes everything, which it did in this case. And the judge, we believe, should have granted mistrial. But without a mistrial, what defense counsel said is, at the very least, let us tell the jury what the terms of the settlement were. This wasn't just a settlement for the payment of money. This was a settlement that involved the transfer of 101 acre feet of water from Western to the plaintiff. The plaintiff's damages model was based on the assumption that he had no usable water for this development. So that assumption was out the window as a result of this settlement. In addition, the plaintiffs were contending that Bertinoli's water rights had zero value, and that's what the jury eventually determined, that they had zero value. Even this notebook has some value, maybe not much, but this jury determined that Bertinoli's 125 acre feet of water rights had zero value. And the fact that Western received Bertinoli's water rights as part of this settlement would have tended to prove, maybe not, but it at least would have raised a reasonable inference that those water rights did in fact have some value. In fact, Mr. Smith had testified that they were worth up to $3,000 an acre foot. So all defense counsel says, look, you know, that changes everything, Judge. You shouldn't approve the settlement in the first place. But if you do, there should be a mistrial because now everything has changed. But if you don't grant a mistrial, at least let us tell the jury what some of the terms of the settlement were.
Is there any authority in the state of Nevada for that? When I was a district court judge and they settled, I never told them about the terms of the settlement.
And that's because in most cases, at least from what I've seen, most cases it's a payment of some money. And the amount of money that the plaintiff is getting in exchange for the settlement is really irrelevant to any of the issue of damages, except later on there's an offset for it. But this situation is different.
Would you key on whether it should have been mistrial versus giving facts to the jury, or should the judge have given facts to the jury and not given the mistrial? And if you're modeling a disposition in this case, how would what would be your preference as the appellant in this matter?
A mistrial. We believe a mistrial because it had already gone too far. This wasn't a settlement on the first day. This was a settlement, like I said, maybe the fifth day. I can't remember. It had already gone too far. And what counsel argued, it wasn't a brilliant legal phrase, but he said it's like defending a moving target. Actually, he made that comment with regard to the judge's changing position. Well, but it was the same thing. But now everything has changed. Counsel complained that throughout the whole trial, the plaintiffs had contended that there was this horrible conspiracy between Western and Bertinoli. Now Western isn't there anymore. And so we believe that mistrial should have been granted. But either way, even if it just should have been a jury instruction allowing the jury, or some evidence allowing the jury to know the terms of the settlement, or some of the terms, a new trial still is necessary. Now I'd like to address the jury instruction number 23 that deals with the word encumbered. You have to keep in mind that these contracts that were here, the retirement, the tire store contract, and the contract with Mr. White for his residential development, those contracts were drafted by Western. Western was the agent for the buyers here. So if there's any ambiguity, they need to be construed against the buyers here. The contracts required Mr. Bertagnoli to deliver unencumbered title to those water rights. Now, the judge had to decide what does the word unencumbered mean. There wasn't any evidence about what the parties meant. In the real property context, unencumbered means that it's free and clear of any liens, mortgages, deeds of trust, or other legal interests. That's what it means. But plaintiff's attorneys were able to convince the judge to broaden the scope of that word and to say that unencumbered really included any burden. Let me make sure I get the exact language. If it's unburdened or unhampered. And counsel took full advantage of that, arguing that because the water couldn't be used in the way the plaintiffs wanted to use it, that it was a burden and it was a hamper, and therefore unencumbered. Now, when I'm preparing for the argument,
Therefore encumbered.
And I thought of the case...
You had said unencumbered.
Pardon?
You had said unencumbered, and I think you meant to say encumbered.
All right.
In other words, they argued that the limitation on use
was
created an encumbrance upon the transferred temporary rights.
Correct. Well, an encumbrance on the use, not the transfer. There was never any question that Bertagnoli had the right and, in fact, did transfer. And that's proved by the fact that the plaintiffs transferred those same rights to Western as part of the settlement. But I got to thinking about this court's recent decision in the Windmill case involving Hann and Carl Hall. Suppose I was going to buy a piece of property out in Washoe Valley and the seller agreed to give me unencumbered title. And I got the title, and there were no liens, mortgages, deed of trust, anything else. But then I decided I wanted to build a windmill, just like the plaintiff in that case did. And I found out that there's a CC&R or some other restriction that prevents me from using that property to build my windmill. Would I be able to sue the sellers and get my money back because my intended use of the property is encumbered?
Isn't this a much more poignant case? Here you've got a purchase of water rights, and you wake up the next day, find out they're temporary water rights that really you can't use, essentially. I see it differently than you do. I don't see that as being quite on point.
If you're water engineer comes to you and says, I've found some water rights that you can use for your residential development. And then your lawyer, and this is what happened in this case, your lawyer says, let's put a provision in the contract that says that you don't have to pay $1 million until the state engineer approves it for your residential development. And the seller, in this case, was going to have a property exchange and couldn't take the risk that there would be a significant delay in the water engineers, in the state engineer's decision. So he said, I can't go along with that. And then you had the choice. Okay, I can either buy these water rights and take the risk that the state engineer might not approve it, or I can go find them somewhere else. And if you decided, okay, I'll scratch out that escrow provision that my lawyer is recommending, and I'll go ahead with this sale without it, then you take the risk that the state engineer might not approve it. Now, that risk may be reasonable because it's your engineer, your water engineer, who's telling you Mr. Bertagnoli's water rights are available for your residential use, and telling Mr. Bertagnoli the same thing, telling everybody they were available.
Couldn't this have all been avoided once Mr. Bertagnoli found out the water rights were temporary in nature, and why did he refuse a refund at that point?
Well, for one thing, we contend that he fully complied with the statute. The contract required him to give title to the water rights as unencumbered, and he complied with that under the real property definition of unencumbered, and it required him to give water rights that were for domestic purposes, and all three permits indicated that was for domestic and rock quarry purposes. So we believe he did comply. But the evidence established, to get to your question, the practical matter, why didn't he refund it? He had done the property exchange. The evidence established that in the meantime, the economy tanked. The property that he exchanged wasn't worth the $1 million, and he didn't have the money. That's what the evidence was. But we contend he didn't have to do it in the first place because he did comply with this, with the contract. The only thing he wanted, if you look at those contracts, both of them, the only thing he wanted was that he would give the title unencumbered. He did not want that it could be used for residential purposes. The last thing I wanted to touch on and try to reserve the rest of my time was the judge's change of mind. You want to talk about something that was unusual that happened during the trial. This was it, where the judge dismissed the fraud claim and the negligent misrepresentation claim. 10 more witnesses testified. They were short. It was only about a day. And then the judge changes his mind, reinstates the fraud and misrepresentation charges. Defense counsel desperately tries to explain the fact that he had changed his theory, changed his strategy, that his examination of witnesses would be different, but the judge reinstates it all, admits that he made an error, and then the case goes forward. So with those three things, the approval of the good faith settlement, the change of the judge's mind, and the definition of encumbered, we contend that a new trial needs to be ordered.
Remember when we wrote Life and the disposition of Life was, we tried to encourage the district judges, if you know you've made a mistake, try to correct it and resolve it. You don't think that's good advice here?
I'm not saying that a judge shouldn't be able to change his mind if he realizes that he makes a mistake, but what we're saying is that if he does change his mind and it's been, and there's that much of a gap and that much has happened, and he has to take adequate steps to avoid prejudice to the party who's affected by that. In some cases, maybe he wouldn't have had to do anything, but we believe that this record shows in this case he needed to take some steps to limit that prejudice. Thank you. I'd like to reserve the remaining part of my time.
My name is Justin Clauser, and I represent Dennis Smith, David Winchell, and their company, Western Engineering and Surveying Services, collectively called Western for purposes of the briefs. My argument is based upon a motion for summary judgment that we feel was improperly denied, not given full hearing or credit. And in my appellate brief, there's been no opposition in this court to my appellate brief for approving or challenging the decision of the district court judge in improperly approving the or denying my motion.
And do you have any standing at this point to make that argument?
Well, that is an issue of contention. There's a corollary in this whole scheme that between the two defendants, Mr. Bertinoli and my clients as the co-defendants, that the relief that is being sought by Mr. Bertinoli is a remand and a new trial on all the issues and bringing Western back in. So this is more of a preemptive insurance policy appeal to see if it goes. That's what my hope is. And there's not been an opposition to this portion of the case by the plaintiff. So I'm asking that basically it be able to stand on its own. If this is remanded and I'm forced to defend Western again in this whole matter, I suppose I do have the right to renew my motion for summary judgment on all the issues because the complaint stands as what it is. But in the effort to try to improve judicial economy and clean up the issues that may honestly exist, that may consider a remand being the remedy, I'd like to be able to send my clients home.
I thought you had a good faith settlement.
Yes.
If you have a good faith settlement and there's co-defendants set a long time from each other, why would you think that you have to, your good faith settlement would be set aside?
Because it's been challenged in this court to have it set aside.
You felt it was a good faith settlement?
Absolutely.
So Mr. Eisenberg's allegations that it wasn't a good faith settlement, that should have been, you should have picked up most of the damages in this case, is not correct in your opinion?
That's correct, Your Honor. But I think the facts and the records support that position, that it was a good faith settlement with all the evidence that existed between the parties, both the defendants among themselves and with the defendants and the plaintiff, that it was a good faith settlement. Yes.
Did the court, in assessing the good faith settlement, value or attempt to value the 101 acre feet of permanent water rights that Western was to transfer?
The value of that? The value of that at the time was estimated to be under the contract that Western had with R&D Land Development, and the value of that was $855,000. That has since changed, as all water rights have changed out in that area.
But at the time of the settlement, the court was advised that the value of the 101 acres was $855,000.
That's correct.
So the settlement benefit to the whites at all was $1 million judgment and $855,000 in water rights.
That's correct. Actually, I misspoke. It was $885,000 was the actual value of the 101 acre feet. That was also in the same, but it was in Basin 103, which is the Dayton Basin.
And were those permanent water rights residential in nature?
Yes, they were permanent water rights, and they were subject to being able to be banked with Lyon County for future development for residential and or municipal purposes.
Okay. Any other questions, Mr. Hauser? All right, thank you,
Your Honors.
Mr. Crawford?
Please, the court. My name is Gene Kaufman, and with me today at council table is J.D. Sullivan. We represent the plaintiffs in this case. We also represented them at the trial court, as well as the clients are Jack White and Retirement LLC. They're with us today in the courtroom, seated right back here, the principals of Retirement and Mr. Jack White. I would like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. While it's fresh in my mind, I'd like to voice my disagreement with the characterization of the value of the water rights. Because the value of the water rights, Western Engineering had sold those water rights several years earlier.
Which water rights are we talking about? The ones that are the subject of the lawsuit? The ones that are to be transferred under the settlement?
Thank you. I should clarify that. I'm talking about the water rights that Western conveyed to our clients as part of their settlement.
Okay.
Those water rights, at the moment of the trial, were the subject of a lawsuit between Ryan and Bardas and Western Engineering. Those water rights had been sold by Western Engineering to Ryan and Bardas several years earlier for $850,000. We told the court that was the contract price. Ryan and Bardas had breached their agreement with Western. Western, in turn, had sued them in Lyon County, and there was a trial set to determine the outcome of what would happen with those water rights. So the value was a value that was 3 years old. They also were subject to litigation. So we advised Judge Wilson, this is what the contract price was, but the offset should be whatever the fair market value of those water rights are today. As to that aspect of the settlement, it should be the fair market value of the water rights. Judge Wilson never made a determination of what the fair market value was. Instead, he said, I don't think it would be fair to give an offset of less than $850,000 as to the water rights, and I don't think it would be fair to give less than the full value of the insurance policy. Even though, again, that aspect of the settlement, the assignment of Western's insurance policy, that was anything but a sure thing either.
This is why I posited the question, counsel. It seems to me that the water rights to be transferred under the settlement agreement were themselves encumbered with a lawsuit.
Exactly.
And operating under an old valuation.
Precisely.
Doesn't that fact go to the question of whether the settlement was in good faith? Because the value your client was to receive was a judgment. I'm not sure it could even be recovered against the malpractice policy. We don't have that information as far as I know. But the water rights you were getting were subject to a lawsuit seriously in dispute, so they were hardly worth $850,000 3 years before. So when we evaluate the good faith determination by the trial judge, if the settlement you got was significantly below Western's exposure, why isn't there an abuse of discretion in approving that motion?
Well, first of all, because the value of the settlement is just one of many factors that the court should consider. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, this court has said in, I think it's the doctor's case, that, this court held in Velsicle that it should be left to the discretion of the trial court based upon all relevant facts available. At the time of the settlement,
there are some enumerated factors that a judge is supposed to consider in determining the reasonableness of the good faith settlement. The exposure, the value of the settlement. What analysis did the judge do of those factors? Specifically, this one.
Well, he did say that it appears to me that the value of the things given in consideration are not grossly disproportionate. He did do an analysis, and he also recognized in that statement that the value wasn't completely clear. But he is mandated by this court's precedents to make the evaluation based upon the available facts. And that's what I'm emphasizing, is the available facts. Because it's the policy of this state, and it's the policy of this court to encourage settlements.
I appreciate that. But in effect, what you're saying, as you began your argument, is that assuming that the jury was correct and the exposure here was $3.7 million plus as to whites, the judge allowed the primary actor in this case out of the case for $1 million judgment against a malpractice carrier and water rights worth some questionable number.
Yes.
That what happened?
I'm sorry?
Is that what happened?
I don't believe that is what happened at all, because I don't agree with the characterization of Western being primarily responsible here. Mr. Bader may sign an agreement.
You told the jury at the beginning of the trial?
Well, of course, you make your argument when you have someone in the case, you make the best argument that you have. And at that point in time, we were suing both Western Engineering and Bader Bailey for fraud, and we were suing them for negligent misrepresentation, and we were suing Western Engineering for professional negligence. But the precedent of this court is as well that we can't recover our economic loss because of professional negligence. So I think it was very unclear whether or not we were going to be able to succeed on our theories against Western Engineering. So the primary issue in this case from our point of view, are these contracts. Western Engineering isn't a party to these contracts. Western Engineering, they didn't agree to transfer water. They brought the parties together, agreed. But Mr. Bertagnoli agreed to transfer unencumbered water rights. And we'll get to the jury instruction in a second here. But from our point of view, what you have is Mr. Bertagnoli making an agreement that he couldn't live up to. And when you look at all the issues that are raised in the Bertagnoli appeal, really only one of them relates to the breach of contract, and that's the jury instruction. Now, Judge Wilson adopted a definition of unencumbered from Webster's. During the time when we were trying to settle the jury instructions, he said, well, don't you just look at what the ordinary meaning of terms are under a contract? And shouldn't we be looking at a Webster's definition of unencumbered? And he settled on the definition that he gave in the case, and that's Volume 1 of the Appendix 185. The word encumbered means without any burdens or impediments. No, I'm sorry, that's the plaintiff's jury instruction there. But he gave a definition right out of Webster's for unencumbered. Mr. Bertagnoli didn't object. He didn't say, no, you need to give a definition of a real property is what this case is about. You need to give a definition from a law dictionary. And in addition to that, the word in the contract is unencumbered. It's not encumbrance. So during the settling of the jury instructions, Mr. Bertagnoli's counsel was urging me to talk about encumbrance out of Black's Law Dictionary. And this is included in our addendum, page 2, the definition of encumbrance from Black's Law Dictionary. And our point was, Your Honor, that's not the word in the contract. The word in the contract is unencumbered. And that is addendum 3, page 3 in our to our brief. And right out of Black's Law Dictionary, it says unencumbered without any burdens or impediments. So we said, Your Honor, it's a legal document. If we're going to give a definition, let's give the legal definition.
Was there any evidence offered in the trial as to what the parties intended by the use of the word?
No, there was not.
Did either party in opening statements claim that the word was ambiguous?
Not to my recollection.
In the absence of that, should the judge have instructed on the word at all?
I think that because the term is it's archaic, I don't think that it's fair to a jury. And again, Mr. Bertagnoli, to my mind, did not object and say you can't define this word for the jury. And in fact, now it seems to me Mr. Bertagnoli is urging, well, we should have used a definition from a legal dictionary, but he's not saying that we can just let the jury decide what that is. But in spite of that, even so, I think there were the testimony from the Western principals was that the water rights, if they were not approved by the state engineer, the money should be refunded. The testimony, that was the expectation of our clients. And in fact, Mr. Bertagnoli initially agreed, per testimony from our clients, that, okay, I'll give you your money back. But then he couldn't perform, understandably, because of the change in the economy. But it seemed that, to me, the strong evidence was that the parties all intended if the water was not approved for transfer, that the money should be refunded. And I think that it was fair for the jury to, even if you didn't have a definition of unencumbered here, that the jury very well would have found, anyway, that the contract was breached. So I don't think that whether or not the term unencumbered is defined or not, and you know, even if we're just simply making our arguments based upon a jury's understanding of unencumbered, I think we still would have had the same result. Because when just an everyday ordinary understanding of unencumbered, the idea that these water rights, they have a restriction on them, that says you cannot use them on a permanent basis. They're only temporary, and they're going to run out, or that the state engineer is not going to allow it for a permanent use, I think even so, there still would have been the same result. And importantly, as I said, there's no objection to the instruction.
See, that's why I'm confused. I thought there was an objection to the instruction, but they proffered that it be defined by absence of arena mortgage.
In the appendix is all of the internal instructions that Mr. Bertagnoli offered. It's volume 1, 194, 195, 196, 197. Those are all of the instructions that he proffered, and there was no definition of unencumbered or of encumbrance or anything to have to do with a lien or a mortgage. And I'll submit that what happened in the case is that, you know, when you have a back and forth in settling jury instructions in a complex civil case, you have a judge who's there. It's almost like a law school debate. And the judge is the professor, and the two lawyers are arguing, well, what should the instructions be? Sometimes you convince each other. And I submit that Mr. Bertagnoli's counsel was convinced that this was a fair instruction. And it allowed him to continue making the arguments that he wanted to make. Because that instruction still talked about lien or mortgage. So he could say, this is what we think the term means, and when we were able to argue that, and the jury resolved that, or they determined that, even apart from that, I think the jury very well could have found that the contract was breached. Because of the testimony that said, if the change in application was not approved, we can, the money will be refunded.
Okay, that's why I have a question, too. Understanding that this apparently involved a 1031 exchange, how can that be? There are very specific timelines that govern that process.
Well, because what Mr. Bertagnoli did with the funds isn't really relevant to the issue of whether or not he had an obligation under the contract to return the money. His obligations under the contract are his obligations under the contract. You know, if I deposit my money with the bank, and they loan it out to somebody and they lose the money, then they're still contractually obligated to give me my money back. The fact that it's difficult for them or that it's economically impossible isn't an excuse. And that's what we submit here is, I just was waiting because you looked at
it. I just was thinking, you know, if you're looking at the party's intent as to the terms of this contract, you know, there was clearly an indication that he was going to do a 1031 exchange. I guess I'm under that impression.
You know, I have there's not a reference in the contract to a 1031 exchange.
Right.
There was some escrow instructions, I believe, that were entered into in pursuance of the contract, and I believe it may be in that context that the 1031 exchange took place.
Okay.
So we submit that the assignments of error that Mr. Bertagnoli has raised in this case largely relate not to errors that Judge Wilson made, but to his own errors, his own failures to bring things up, his failure to object to the jury instructions. For example, he brings a NRCP 60 motion. I want a new trial because of newly discovered evidence. Judge Wilson, in denying that motion, said Mr. Bertagnoli sets forth no reason why he could not have discovered the evidence he said wasn't available to him through due diligence. Mr. Bertagnoli doesn't do his due diligence, doesn't find the evidence he needs. Oh, it's an assignment of error. Another example, Mr. Bertagnoli never designated Pete Morris as an expert. This is not a case of a late designated expert. This is a case of someone never complying whatsoever with NRCP 16.1. No expert report, no CV, no schedule of fees, nothing. He simply wanted to bring this guy in and have him testify. We objected. We should have the opportunity to depose Mr. Morris and find out what the basis of his opinions are, cross-examine him. That would have been impossible in the middle of a trial. And So is that an error? No. It's Mr. Bertagnoli's failure to timely designate an expert. Mr. Bertagnoli made other tactical errors, such as he never took the deposition of Tom Cargill, our economic expert. He misunderstood what the basis of Mr. White's damages were. They weren't lost profits. It was consequential damages from the breach. He said, I bought the land only because you had promised me to deliver the water. I incurred these engineering expenses only because you promised to deliver me the water. And he didn't incur those expenses until after the water rights had been sold to him. Yes, he was already looking at the development. He was in escrow, but he hadn't spent the money. That's why his damages consisted of, not lost profits. And so if Mr. Bertagnoli then assigns an error, oh, it's speculations based on lost profits. No, it's not. If you look at the testimony of Mr. Cargill, it's basically consequential damages. We believe that Judge Wilson did not make any error with respect to the good faith settlement. He examined the factors he was mandated to look for, but in hindsight, you may change a little bit. You may look at it and think, well, did he make the right decision or not? But he has to make that decision in the midst of trial on the facts that are available at the time. We submit that he did make an error with respect to the amount of the offset, because the statute says the offset shall be in the amount of the consideration paid. Not what the judge thinks is fair, in the amount of the consideration paid. The consideration in this case were water rights and a lawsuit against an insurance company. He needed to evaluate that. He said during the settlement hearing, I'll hold a hearing afterward to determine the value of the settlement. We said, yes, Your Honor, do that. He didn't do that. The plaintiffs should be able to rely on what the judge said, but more importantly, they should be able to rely on what the statute says. And the statute says it shall be in the amount of the consideration paid. We think that the judgments should be upheld in all respects, with the case remanded to Judge Wilson with instructions that he needs to determine the value of the consideration paid and set the offset in that amount. With that, if there's any time that I have left, I'll reserve it.
Given the fact that it's 16 seconds, I'll treat it as expired. Thank you.
Your Honor, I'm not sure how the timing of this is going to work. Before we started, Mr. Clauser told me he was going to stand up here and tell you he didn't intend to argue. Based on that representation, I agreed to give him 1 minute of my time. He ended up being up here for about 4 or 5 minutes, so I'm not sure how much I have left.
You have 3 minutes. Go ahead, sir.
3 minutes? Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that. I wanted to start by addressing the point about whether the settlement amount could be ascertained. It wasn't just the value of the water that was being given. It was also, to a great extent, the value of the bad faith claim against the insurance company. In the cross appeal, they clearly contend right now that at the time of the trial, the settlement amount could not be ascertained. And my answer to that is, if that's true, then how on earth could the judge have approved the settlement as being in good faith if the amount couldn't be ascertained? Justice Perry, you asked to change the subject here about the preservation of the issue regarding the definition of unencumbered. In my reply brief at pages 38 to 40, I identify 8 different times when Mr. Bertagnoli's counsel asserted the position that unencumbered meant, in the real property sense, and even if he shouldn't have cited the Black's Law Dictionary, he asserted the position that it meant free and clear of any liens, mortgages, or deeds of trust. Counsel says, he almost argues that it was a condition proceeding, approval by the state engineer, that once the state engineer didn't approve it, Brittonelli should have given the money back. Well, if they wanted that to be a condition preceding in the contract, all they had to do was put it in there. And that's basically what their lawyer advised initially. He said, let's have an escrow. You put the water in, we put the money in, and when the state engineer approves it, then everybody gets what they bargained for. But that was taken out. And so it was not a condition preceding to a performance of this contract. Council says, yeah, we told the court that they were confident they would win the suit against Western, but they did tell the court that. He says that they weren't sure they could win the case against Western. Well, at trial, they were pretty sure, and in the pretrial papers, what they told the court was that there was clear and convincing evidence exists as to Western's fraud perpetrated on the plaintiffs. And then in the opening statement, they clearly told the jury that Western had committed fraud and misrepresentations. And they did flip-flop. They were very, very confident on that point.
Mr. Eisenberg, on the issue of good faith settlement, Mr. Kaufman makes the point they would have had some concern about recovering economic loss damages on a professional negligence claim. Wouldn't that be a factor the judge would take into consideration in determining the good faith of the settlement?
Well, that would be a factor that would create uncertainty, which I think would be would go to the how much the settlement was worth. And so that would tend to show that the settlement could not be approved in good faith, because if the judge can't figure out how much it's worth, how can he approve it as being in good faith? But what was raised at trial, what they told the trial judge, was not that concern. It was a concern regarding notice, that there was a defense in the bad faith case based on whether there had to be the notice was late and whether that had to be prejudice. And they told the trial judge, well, we've got a law professor who says that we're in good shape on this issue. And as it turns out, the law professor was correct. This court abandoned the prejudice requirement. So that was the issue that created the uncertainty regarding the $1 million insurance policy. In addition, they had a bad faith claim, and I suppose you could say that there was some uncertainty regarding bad faith.
Do my colleagues have any questions? All right. Thank you, Mr. Eisenberg.
Thank you,
counsel, for your arguments today and your briefs in this matter. It stands. Pardon me?
May I
address
the court just 16
seconds.
16 seconds.
Okay.
This is from volume 11 of the appendix. 2230 is the page. The court, do you have any objections to these instructions? Instructions 1 through 38. Mr. Williams, no. The court, no objections to any of these instructions? Mr. Williams, correct. One other point. There is a California case that says you cannot determine whether there's a good faith settlement or not if you do not know the value. But in that case, the California court remanded it to the district court for a redetermination as to whether or not the settlement was in good faith based upon the determination of what the value was. At the very worst, that's what should happen in this case. The case, the judgment should be upheld. Thank you.
Mr. Coughlin, you made extraordinary good use of your 16 seconds. Thank you all very much for your arguments, and the case will stand submitted.